We'll hear arguments next in the city of Revere against Massachusetts General Hospital. Mr. Zalesnik, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue before this Court is whether a municipality is obligated by the Constitution to reimburse a hospital for the costs of medical treatment rendered to a person suspected of crime. Let me briefly summarize the facts. On September 20th, 1978, Revere police were called to respond to a reported burglary at a dwelling house in Revere, Massachusetts. The police arrived at the scene, observed an individual leaving the home with a suitcase and a pillowcase, and this individual was later identified as one Patrick Kivlin. As a result, the police sought to detain him, and Mr. Kivlin attempted to flee. After repeated warnings and then a warning shot, Mr. Kivlin was shot by a police officer for the city of Revere.
Now, that's when the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts said he was under arrest, since that bullet hit him.
Yes, Your Honor, except that the Revere police secured an arrest warrant from the Chelsea District Court, the local court of appropriate jurisdiction.
Later on,
mm-hmm. after, while Mr. Kivlin was still in the hospital.
Well, when they picked him up off the street to take him to the hospital, was he arrested then?
We would submit that he was not, other than in the practical sense that he could not, he was incapacitated and could not move away on his own. But we would not contend that there is any meaning to custody at that stage. As a practical matter, the suspect was in need of emergency medical attention, and the police officers for the city of Revere did the appropriate thing. They called an ambulance. The ambulance arrived and took Mr. Kivlin to the emergency ward at Massachusetts General Hospital.
Does the record show why they took him to MGH rather than Boston City?
It does not, Your Honor, except geographically. Massachusetts General Hospital is closer.
Much? Not very much.
Well, it depends upon the time of day, but I believe that as a matter of course.
Does the time of day make distance?
In terms of traffic conditions at the scene.
But at least Boston City was a municipal hospital. MGH, theoretically, is a private one.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
What was the reason for taking them to MGH other than closeness in terms of traffic?
I would think no other, Your Honor. I believe that the judgment exercised in this regard was exercised by the ambulance driver.
Well, the result is that you're imposing this this cost on a private hospital in contrast to imposing it on a municipal hospital.
No, we are not claiming in this litigation, Your Honor, that it is the private hospital that must bear this burden. We are simply saying that, and the issue before this Court is whether or not the city must bear this burden as a matter of constitutional mandate.
Well,
who bears the burden is...
Aren't you weaseling words there? The city doesn't want any responsibility for it. Let somebody else pay for it.
Well, the decision of who pays is necessarily a legislative one and properly belongs with the legislature or the Congress and not the courts, at least under the circumstances of this particular case.
May I ask this question? As a matter of federal law, as soon as the person was shot, did the police or the city of Revere have any federal obligation to him at all? Could they have just let him lie there?
No, Your Honor. I would not contend that
what,
the Revere
what
police...
What federal obligation, if any, did they have to the man as he's, before they picked him up and took him to the hospital?
I believe that the police officers had the obligation to call the ambulance to provide him with access to emergency medical attention.
As a matter of federal constitutional law?
Yes, because I believe to...
What if when the ambulance driver picked him up and took him to the hospital said, we're not going to take him in unless we know who's going to pay the bill?
Then that is not a deprivation of rights that Revere has visited
But
on
if
a
that had happened, substance. If that had happened, would the city of Revere had any further federal constitutional obligation at that point in time?
I believe not.
Not even to take him to some other hospital?
I do not believe so.
But you say they have an obligation to pick him up and put him in an ambulance, but they don't have any obligation to make sure that the ambulance gets any place that will do him any good. Rather strange federal obligation.
The reason is, that I would submit, Your Honor, is out of the negative. Were they to leave him lying on the street, or were they to take him to the station house and attempt to undergo the normal booking procedures while he was injured and in need of medical attention, that would be a way of inflicting punishment upon him. And that's where I believe they would run afoul of the constitutional requirements.
But could one not say precisely the same thing about leaving him in an ambulance unintended in a parking lot of a hospital?
No, because as a practical matter, the ambulance driver doesn't simply leave him there, and really the threat that you speak of is simply hypothetical one.
Well, but I'm asking not the driver, but the city. You say the city had the obligation to put him in an ambulance in order to avoid the risk that he would just suffer great pain on the street, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if he continues to suffer pain in the ambulance and there's no one around, no doctor around to alleviate that pain, does their duty terminate, or do they have a continuing duty until they find somebody who will take care of them? That's, I guess, what I'm asking.
Well, I do not believe the duty is continuing, but it's a fact pattern that is not presented in this case as the...
But what is the duty?
The duty
is... You say it's not continuing. Well, what is it?
The duty is not to deny him access to medical attention, and not to.
You say that's not continuing.
It is simply not to inflict punishment on him by refusing to.
Well, then, when he's carried to the hospital and he sits out there, and the hospital won't take him, and they put him out in the grounds and leave him there, is that the end of the duty?
I do not believe that the city has a continuing obligation. At that stage,
I think you've bit off a little more than you're going to be able to chew.
See, the point is, if I understand your position, the hospital doesn't, if you win, the hospital will not get paid. Presumably, they'll just turn these people away. So what happens as a result of the federal constitutional duty then? Don't they just sit in the parking lot in an ambulance?
That danger is really a hypothetical one. And as demonstrated in the facts of this particular case, the hospital will not simply turn the people away. The hospital is under a series of obligations.
They have no guarantee they would be paid when this person was dumped at their door, did they?
They had no guarantee whatsoever.
They still took him.
Nonetheless, they took him, and what's more, under the facts of the case, they took him a second time, fully a week after the chief of the Revere Police Department notified them that the Revere had no intention of paying this particular bill.
Yes. Are there any federal or state laws that require private general hospitals open to the public to take emergency cases, counsel?
There is an express law in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts by statute which provides that any hospital with an emergency wing must provide emergency medical care to all those who need it. And the fact is, it's a matter of policy and custom as well as law, that hospitals provide emergency medical care to those in need without regard to the source of payment. And that is the language of the particular statute.
Is this hospital a tax-exempt organization, do you know?
Massachusetts General Hospital is a nonprofit organization. And if you
so that
look
There's some sort of a quid pro quo in your intimation that if you've got that kind of a benefit, you take on some burdens like emergency treatment.
Necessarily, when the hospital opens its doors and says to the public that it has an emergency wing, it must necessarily provide the emergency services that are required. The difference, and what may well have occurred under had the hospital realized that Revere would not pay this bill, is perhaps the hospital would not have permitted the patient to stay in the hospital for the full 10 days. And at that stage, after stabilizing him and giving him the emergency medical treatment, they could have transferred him to Boston City Hospital or another publicly supported institution.
Well, why should Boston City accept him?
Because Boston City is a publicly supported institution.
No, but it isn't a Revere Hospital. Revere is not part of the city of Boston, is it?
But it is obligated to accept.
It's fine for you to say MGH should take care of the emergency and then, what, put him out in the street? Suppose that Boston City says we're full.
The Boston City is under an obligation to, and as are publicly supported hospitals, to treat those in
emergency rooms. Why couldn't MGH say we have a fine emergency facility here, even though you have to wait for 20 hours sometimes? Why couldn't they say we'll take emergency pain patients, period?
Because state law says...
All right. Suppose you had no such state law. Then what?
I think there is a common law obligation.
What's your argument implies, I'm not saying it's wrong, is that maybe MGH closed its emergency wing.
If it sought to avoid the outcome in this case, and if its appeals to the legislature to do something with regard to the specific facts of this case were unavailing, that might well be their alternative.
Well, don't hospitals accepting Medicare or federally funded patients have a requirement to provide certain emergency services? I mean, aren't they required under federal regulations to offer a certain range of services in order to qualify?
Yes, Your Honor. Under certain circumstances, hospitals that do accept federal aid are required to provide treatment to indigents. And there are a series of legislative enactments in this area, perhaps not one that satisfies this particular case.
Let me try another hypothetical on you addressed at testing the Massachusetts court's theory about arrest as soon as this fellow was hit with a bullet. Suppose the policeman hadn't been such a good marksman, and instead of hitting this man, he'd hit a tourist, a spectator. And that person was taken to the hospital and given all the same treatment. Now, we've removed the arrest theory. What about that situation?
In that situation, assuming that the individual did not have a state law tort remedy against the individual officer, so that assuming that there's no fault, as there's no indication in this case that there was any fault on the part of Revere Police, the hospital is left in the identical situation. An individual hurt in need of medical attention goes to the hospital and must receive treatment.
Then this fanciful theory about being arrested when the bullet hit him is irrelevant in your view to the case?
In my view, it is irrelevant and ought not to be viewed as dispositive by this court. If I may elaborate on your hypothetical, suppose Mr. Kivlin, the suspect, had a gun and had, in the circumstances of this case, had fired a shot that hit that bystander prior to the time that the policeman felled Mr. Kivlin with his bullet. Under that circumstance, we would have had two ambulances or two people in the ambulance, one the suspect, one an innocent bystander, left in the same position. Under the Supreme Judicial Court's formulation, the suspect would have a guaranteed right to free medical care, and the innocent bystander clearly would not. I think it demonstrates that the injured suspect in this case was in no different position from any citizen who is injured on the street and in need of emergency medical care. I would like to address a threshold issue for a moment. That is Massachusetts General Hospital's challenge to the jurisdiction of this court. According to Massachusetts General Hospital, only state law issues are involved in this case, and there is, or at least there is, an independent and adequate state law remedy to support state law ground to support the judgment below. This view rests on a single premise, that the opinion below was based upon a state-created implementing rule, a matter of state law, and that what the Supreme Judicial Court did was merely create a so-called implementing rule. This viewpoint distorts the plain language of the opinion below, as well as the state law precedents relied on by the Supreme Judicial Court in the court below. The language of the opinion could hardly be plainer. After rejecting all forms of state law contractual recovery, the court below held, and I quote, "We hold that the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment embodied in the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution requires that Revere be liable to the hospital for the medical services rendered to Kivlin during his first stay." Later in the opinion, in its section entitled Eighth Amendment, the court characterizes the position of the hospital as follows. The hospital argues that the prohibition against deliberate indifference to the medical needs of prisoners contained implicitly in the Eighth Amendment compels a government agency or division responsible for supplying those medical needs to pay for them. In response to this assertion, the Supreme Judicial Court responded with two words, "We agree." The opinion below that Revere must be liable to the hospital is clearly a matter of federal law and is clearly derived in the minds of the Supreme Judicial Court from the Eighth Amendment. There can be no independent and adequate state law ground to support the judgment below, since the Supreme Judicial Court held in the first part of the opinion that it would be illegal for Revere, under the circumstances of this particular case, to pay Massachusetts General Hospital. Under the law of the Commonwealth, Massachusetts has strict rules against allowing any form of contractual recovery against a municipality unless the prerequisites to a valid contract are in place. Therefore, the phrase that Mass General uses in this context, its implementing rule, is simply a polite way of trying to reintroduce its theory of an implied contract, implied contract that requires that Revere pay the bill of Mass General. This theory was rejected by the court below. Therefore, there is no state law ground upon which to rest the judgment below. Rather, the judgment below clearly rests upon the Supreme Judicial Court's erroneous interpretation of the United States Constitution. With respect to the standing issue, I would suggest to the court that the prudential concerns behind the standing doctrine ought to operate to deny Mass General the right to raise the constitutional rights of the suspect in the context of this particular case. In this case, based upon the record, no rights of the suspect were violated, and the only threat, if indeed there is one, comes from the implied threat of Massachusetts General Hospital not to treat in future cases.
Well, Mr. Zalesnik, Are we in a position to impose our rules as to standing on the highest court of the state?
In this circumstance, in the context of this case, Your Honor, this court is free to judge by federal rules of standing, since it is clear in the court's footnote in the opinion below that it was applying federal laws of standing. And therefore, it is a federal question that this court is free to consider. Had they applied state law rules of standing, then I would agree, Your Honor, the issue would be foreclosed. But under these circumstances, I think the issue is open to this court.
Which footnote is it that you rely on for that?
This is footnote number 7 on pages 26 and 27 of the record appendix.
Thank you.
The citations are to the Barrows case and to a treatise on the federal courts by Professor Wright.
Well, of course, they also say in that footnote that there was no standing question raised or argued in the case before them, and they deem it waived.
Yes, Your Honor, but I nonetheless submit that the issue is properly before the court. The Supreme Judicial Court, when it ruled that the Eighth Amendment itself contained an obligation to pay on the part of Revere, went beyond anything that was argued in the court below. What Mass General argued in the court below was that the constitutional duty involved created a duty upon which to rest an implied contract, so that they only invoked the Constitution as creating this duty of municipality to hospital, and then the right to force payment was resting as a function of implied contract. Therefore, since the issue was not framed the way the Supreme Judicial Court framed it, and there was no opportunity to raise a standing question in this fashion, I believe this issue is still properly before the court. Even if this court were to not accept that contention, I would submit that the issue is properly before this court because the Supreme Judicial Court, although it suggested that the issue was waived, nonetheless proceeded to decide it. And having decided the question, the issue is now properly before this court.
May I ask you a question about that? Supposing we agreed with you on your standing argument, and we concluded that Mass General has no standing to raise the federal constitutional question, should we then not ourselves refuse to reach the merits of the federal constitutional question and merely vacate the judgment and send it back to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and let it determine whether, as a matter of state law, they're standing? I think you're arguing we do not have jurisdiction to review the merits of the federal issue.
My argument is not an Article III argument, Your Honor.
Well, but even if it's prudential, you're saying as a matter of our own prudential rules, we should not address the merits.
Yes, but
isn't that like saying that, in effect, the Massachusetts court has given an advisory opinion on a federal constitutional question?
In the context of this particular case, it was not an advisory opinion, Your Honor. They clearly decided the question, and if it were up to this court, then the court is free to simply reverse the judgment below, and there's no need for a remand in this context.
Well, supposing a state had a procedure whereby its Supreme Court could render advisory opinions, and they were asked to render an advisory opinion on this very issue, and they said, well, the bill's been paid in this case, but we want to set the law for the future. And they said, as a matter of federal Eighth Amendment law, these bills must be paid by the city. This court couldn't review such an advisory opinion, could it?
That's correct, Your Honor, but in this circumstance, the issue of standing was heard and determined as a matter of federal law.
Right, but you're saying
law.
We should reverse their determination of standing. But it seems to me, once we do that, we should not have the power to go forward and, or maybe I missed your argument, and decide the merits.
At that point, I believe the judgment should be reversed.
At least, right.
But my only disagreement is whether or not there should be a remand at that particular stage to the Supreme Judicial Court. The only issue that they decided was one of federal law, and I believe that there's no need.
No, but you're telling me they decided two issues of federal law. One, the merits, and two, the standing.
Yes, Your Honor, but they decided standing simply as a matter of federal law. There's no state law of standing intertwined with that opinion. So that if...
Sort of pendant jurisdiction.
But it was not raised at any point in the proceedings along...
It wasn't raised. It's not here.
I agree that the only issue before this...
It appears to me that the Massachusetts Supreme Court just went completely off base and decided a federal question which they had no right to decide. Either one of them.
I would...
Is that your position? Because if that's your position, you don't win.
They had the right to decide it, but we believe that they decided it in both circumstances in an erroneous fashion. Ultimately, the broad issue as to whether there is any obligation to reimburse the hospital is a policy question. And this policy question ought to be directed towards the state legislature or perhaps even to the Congress and not to the court. This is a matter of state law, not constitutional law, and I would respectfully submit that there is no constitutional entitlement to the funds in these circumstances. Since there is no constitutional entitlement to reimbursement, I would respectfully request that this Court reverse the judgment of the Supreme Judicial Court of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Thank you. I reserve any remaining time to rebuttal.
Mr. Broad.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The initial question in this case is, in fact, the question of jurisdiction and the question of standing. And the petitioner, of course, has the burden of establishing that jurisdiction. Nonetheless, the petitioner comes to this Court arguing now that the hospital lacks standing. The hospital suggests to the Court that on the basis of that allegation and that argument, the Court should properly dismiss the writ of certiorari, accepting the petitioner's claim that there is no standing in the federal sense. I suggest that the resolution ought to be to dismiss the writ and not to reverse the court below, because, of course, the state court is free to fashion a broader rule of standing than the federal court would be free.
But your opponent contends, as I understand it, Mr. Broad, that the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court didn't do that here, that by citing Barrows against Jackson, they simply thought they were or intended to follow the federal rule of standing.
I think in order to determine what the court in fact did, Justice Rehnquist, we might look very closely at that footnote 7 on page 26 of the appendix, to which my brother has already referred. The footnote consists of two and only two paragraphs. The first paragraph acknowledges that there may be a question of standing, but finds it waived, clearly as a matter of state law, citing the applicable state rule of appellate procedure. Now, my brother construes the second paragraph as a decision on the federal question of standing, and I firmly disagree. The second paragraph starts out, "Furthermore, standing to litigate constitutional issues is sometimes granted to persons." The Court is making clearly the observation that it would not be unheard of as a matter of jurisprudence for a third party to have standing in a case like this. But I find nothing whatsoever in that paragraph that suggests that the Supreme Court purports to decide or, in fact, has decided that issue. Indeed, the two references in the paragraph to which my brother has already referred, the two federal references, are preceded by a C cite and a CF cite. And I suggest that is not the way that the Court would have decided the federal issue if it purported to do so. So on the basis of that,
you have to get out the blue book of citations to decide whether it's an adequate and independent state ground.
I suggest that what the Court has done is decided it as a matter of state law, Your Honor, pointing out in passing And this is not so uncommon for a state court.
What state law were they passing on?
The waiver question, Your Honor, as a matter of state law. The question of waiver.
Which state law?
Whether, as a matter of state law, the question of standing can
be
waived.
Well, you said they were passing on state law, and I'm asking you, which state law?
I'm not saying, Your Honor, a state statute. I'm saying a state rule of procedure and a state rule of waiver.
Common law?
It's in part common law. It's in part codified in the rule of appellate procedure 16A4, cited on the bottom of page 27. Now, where the federal court might properly decide that a standing issue is jurisdictional and can never be waived, the state court may properly take a different approach. And that's exactly what's happened in this case. And in fact, in other cases, the Supreme Judicial Court has expressly declined to follow federal rules of standing. In this case, where the state court parted company with the federal rule, with the federal approach, I submit, is on the question of waiver, and found that that issue had been waived.
Well, what makes you think that that's parting company with the federal rule?
Well, perhaps I've overspoken, Your Honor, and it's certainly not essential to my argument that that would be parting company, just that it's clearly presented here in the first paragraph solely as a state law issue. I suggest, therefore, that because it is open to the state court to adopt a rule of standing that allows waiver, whether or not the federal court would have done the same thing under those circumstances, is fully appropriate for a state court as a matter of state law. And it would be improper for this court, with all respect, to reverse the state court on that ground and tell the state court that it had to do something different, that it had to follow a different rule, because perhaps that would be the federal rule. Now, in the rest of the decision in this case, the hospital suggests that the state Supreme Court was recognizing, implicitly or explicitly, certain special circumstances in Massachusetts that ought to govern the resolution of this case. My brother has stood before the court this morning and announced, this afternoon, I'm sorry, and announced that this is a question that should be decided as a matter of policy. And we agree. We think it was decided as a matter of policy, and that the decision below fully reflects the state policies. Now, in Massachusetts, unlike most states, there is both a state rate-setting commission that sets hospital rates, that fixes the rates that we can charge, and there is also a revenue cap that places a ceiling, a limitation, on the aggregate gross revenue of a hospital, so that in two different ways, a hospital's revenues are severely curtailed by the state. Recognizing that fact, which has received an incredible amount of publicity in the state, and recognizing also, as the Supreme Judicial Court did in the early section of this opinion, that none of the traditional elements of the state common law would have provided a payment rule, it was, we submit, fully appropriate for the court to go on and ask the obvious next question, which is, at least given the current financial circumstances in the state of Massachusetts, and the fact that hospitals, such as the Massachusetts General Hospital, have found it necessary to impose, for example, wage and salary freezes, that some hospitals have started laying off employees, that
Is the city of Revere overloaded with money?
Overloaded with money?
Is it?
I don't know the answer. I suspect the answer is no. But what the city of Revere is trying to do in this case, Your Honor, is to shift its burden, its obligation, onto the hospital. And we think that is inappropriate. It would certainly be open to the city of Revere if it felt desirable.
Well, first we have to know whether there is an obligation to shift, don't we?
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but
I
heard counsel very clearly start out this afternoon by acknowledging that there was at least some obligation to do at least something to provide treatment. And I suggest that he stopped too soon in expressing that obligation, and that, for example, merely picking up the injured party who was, by the acknowledgement of the Revere police, and this appears in the appendix at page 11, that the Revere police came to the hospital and informed hospital personnel that the suspect was then under arrest.
Are you talking now, Mr. Broad, about a federal constitutional obligation?
A federal constitutional obligation, Your Honor, not to be deliberately indifferent to the medical needs of a person in custody. And I think the state Supreme Court took that underlying constitutional obligation as essentially undisputed. Yes, Revere argues a bit about whether the person was really in custody or not in this case, and the state court disposes of that rather quickly.
Well, perhaps questions from the bench have sidetracked you from what I thought was your argument, that this is basically a state law ground, ultimately, that the Supreme Judicial Court has taken, rather than the I had not understood you at this point to be defending the federal constitutional basis.
I think Your Honor understands my argument correctly and has stated it, in fact, quite well. All I'm pointing out is that I think in fashioning this state rule, this state implementing rule, that the state Supreme Court could legitimately have in mind the goal of protecting the underlying constitutional argument.
But you're here to defend an opinion of the state Supreme Court, the highest court, that there is a federal basis for the obligation, a federal constitutional basis for the obligation that you talk about. Is that not so?
That's not how I would read the opinion, at least.
Well, what's the Eighth Amendment discussion about?
I think, Your Honor, that what the state court did was to fashion a rule to protect an underlying constitutional right without saying that the particular implementing rule was itself required by the Constitution. It's not unusual, Your Honor, to see in cases a question of remedy. And the essence of structuring a remedy is, of course, making a choice among various alternatives that might be open.
Well, but wouldn't you think if it were an implementing rule that's state-based, that a far more, certainly the justices of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts know how to write opinions as well as everyone else, that would have appeared in the first part of the opinion, where you're talking about various state law bases for recovery, not in, as your opponent has quoted, the first two sentences of the section called Eighth Amendment on 5A, where they say the hospital argues the prohibition against deliberate indifference compels a government agency or division responsible for supplying those medical needs to pay for them. And then they say, we agree. There's no intimation, there's any bridge there between the constitutional obligation and the result.
The transition there, Your Honor, I agree, may be a bit choppy. If I could refer the court to the top of page 29 in the appendix and the bottom of page 28. Now, this is the part of the opinion where the court is really getting into the discussion of the issue as opposed to the preliminaries. And the court says that the person in question was brought to the hospital as a prisoner, I'm reading from the bottom of page 28, and that Revere has a legal duty to supply him with necessary medical care, and then goes on to say to ensure the prisoner's right to medical care. I think that speaks of implementing. To ensure the right to medical care, Revere must be held liable to the hospital. And notice, Your Honor, that the two citations that follow that are citations to state cases, not to federal cases, not to federal constitutional cases. So I would suggest that perhaps the court would not have reached that question if it had not been concerned with ultimately protecting an acknowledged federal constitutional right, but that a state court ought to have greater latitude to fashion the means for protecting the right than perhaps a federal court would, because obviously the intrusion that a federal court can justify into the state sphere is limited, and this court has held that repeatedly in cases like Milliken versus Bradley.
Well, why couldn't that court have simply said that when a policeman who is not a federal officer in Massachusetts shoots anyone, there's an obligation to take care of the wound? That'd be totally state law, wouldn't it?
That would be.
It wouldn't be any of our business by what gyrations they arrived at that conclusion, would it?
Well, it could be put as a matter of state law. It could also have been put that hypothetical as a matter of federal constitutional law. But the next question is it open to a state court, as opposed to the federal court, to go a step further and specify the means by which the prisoner's medical treatment is to be guaranteed? Certainly, the state Supreme Court had to realize that it would have been open to a prisoner whose constitutional rights were violated to bring an action under, for example, 1983. And in such a case, we might have expected to see in the state court repeated inquiry into the particular special circumstances of each of the individual cases.
Just what about as this court, Chief Justice's earlier question that he missed the culprit and shot an innocent bystander, the same policeman? Revere wouldn't be responsible for that bill, would they?
There is no underlying constitutional obligation to provide care for an innocent bystander.
So
I agree, Your Honor, under this opinion.
The thug gets protection that an ordinary citizen doesn't get.
Well, in general, Your Honor, when a person is in custody, Your Honor, I suggest
generally held.
In Harris versus McRae, this court very clearly held that the government does not, in general, have an obligation to provide funding to allow its citizens to exercise what may otherwise be their constitutional rights. But there are cases of this court, and the cases are legion in the lower federal courts, in which the state has clearly been found to have an obligation and an obligation to pay to ensure the constitutional rights of a very limited class of people, and I'm talking about those people who are in state custody, in state institutions, or in state schools for people who are mentally disabled.
The trouble with your argument is, if I heard you correctly, you said there are a multitude of cases in federal district courts on that. And this is a state court decision,
That's correct.
A federal court decision, which is the point we've been trying to get through to you.
And I suggest, if anything, Your Honor, the state court ought to have greater deference and greater opportunity to fashion the rule than a federal court would. Yes, this is clearly a state court decision. If this were a federal court decision, then I think this court, would be required to review it quite closely and carefully.
You better stick to this one and not try to decide other ones.
I think that would be the case if this were a federal court decision, because the federal court would have had to limit carefully its intrusion into state affairs. But in a state court decision, that's not the case.
Mr. Broad, may I ask you a question about the portion of the opinion that begins the Eighth Amendment discussion and has the footnote 7 about waiver in it, and then they say, we agree, you know, the argument that the hospital argues the prohibition against deliberate indifference and so forth includes an obligation to pay. And your opponent, as I understood his argument, said that the reason there shouldn't be a waiver, as the court says in the footnote, is that they really didn't make the argument that the Massachusetts court said you made. Is that correct?
Well, I was not trial counsel, Your Honor, so I don't know what happened at argument in the case. But reading the brief, I think it may be, in all candor, a little bit unclear exactly what argument was made. It's clear that the hospital raised the Eighth Amendment, I think incorrectly, probably should have been the 14th Amendment, if I may say, with an idea of alerting the state court to the fact that there was an underlying responsibility.
But he says the argument was that the Eighth Amendment created a duty to take him to the hospital, but that gave rise to an implied contract to pay, and that as a matter of state law, you can't have such an implied contract.
That's not stated at least so clearly in the brief, Your Honor, to be able to determine which way it came down. And I would suggest that, consistent with the opinions of this court, insofar as it may not be entirely clear whether we have a federal law decision, a state law decision, or some amalgam intertwining the two, that it would be appropriate for this court to remand the case to the state Supreme Court under a Minnesota versus National Tea approach and suggest respectfully that the state court might clarify that issue. Because as this court has observed,
given at least stand in a state court opinion which gives a state court the right to decide a federal standing point.
Well, I suggest, Your Honor, that the federal...
Doesn't it?
I don't believe, with all respect, that the federal standing question was decided in this case. Now, it may be that we're reading that footnote differently, but I think it was decided... That might also be
a question... Or should we leave that possibility there?
You might also, if it's unclear to the court what the basis was for that section of the decision, it might also be remanded under a national...
Frankly, it's not unclear to me. I can only speak for one.
All right, I understand. I'd like to address, at least briefly, some questions that were raised by the court in the city's argument. The question of other obligations that might exist for the provision of care by the hospital. My brother made reference to a state law, by which I assume he meant the Patient's Bill of Rights in Massachusetts, Massachusetts General Laws, Chapter 111, Section 70E, which, in fact, did not become effective until the year following the events that gave rise to this case, and therefore, as at least a technical matter, has no bearing here. But I'd like to read the first words of the relevant section of that part of the statute that talks about the right of a hospital patient. And it says it gives the hospital patient the right to prompt life-saving treatment, not emergency treatment, prompt life-saving treatment in an emergency. Clearly, the state legislature in that statute has cut out a much more circumscribed area of medical care than my brother would have suggested, I think, in his argument. In our brief, we have also cited relevant sections from the Medicare Hospital Manual at footnote 58 on page 34 of the brief, where the federal government, or at least an agency of the government, very clearly takes the position that Medicare payment may not be made for services provided to prisoners because the state or other governmental agency is already responsible for their medical care. In general, the position of the hospital in this case is, first, that the court ought not reach the merits because it should find that the state court was free to have decided the case under state rules of standing, but that, as argued by the petitioner, this court ought not proceed to decide the case, the standing question, on the merits, should accept the allegation of petitioner, and should dismiss the writ for lack of standing. But if the court were inclined to go further, we suggest first that the decision is not a constitutional decision, but is an implementing decision, and that while the state courts do not have the authority to misinterpret the Constitution, they should clearly be allowed the authority to craft a remedy that might be somewhat broader than a federal court could do in seeking to protect the underlying constitutional rights, in order to protect in advance and make it unnecessary for a prisoner later to bring an action for damages, clearly a less satisfactory alternative. And finally, insofar as there may be some disagreement among members of the court or some uncertainty in the mind of the court as to the exact basis of the decision on either point, whether state or federal, the hospital suggests in conclusion that it would be more appropriate to ask the state court what was intended than to presume to tell it.
Thank you. Do you have anything further, Mr. Zalesnik?
Just one point, Your Honor. My brother points to a single sentence at page 29 of the appendix, at page 779 of the opinion, as justifying reading the court below as creating a state implementing rule. But that sentence was followed by two sentences saying that inadequate funding will not excuse deprivation of constitutional rights, and that even though a payment may be in violation of state or local law, will not avail relief, revere of any relief. So that it is clear that what the court below did was to base its ruling on an erroneous interpretation of the federal United States Constitution and not any sort of state law implementing remedy. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.